Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by Edward Bagues from Open.com. Hey, man.
Hey, Jan. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. And I guess it's been a while since we met each other on my workshop, Production Ready Serverless. I think at the time you were telling me that you were taking a workshop to better help your developers at Open.com, and that you guys were building this cloud-native banking platform, and you're based in, I guess, quite a few countries around Europe and headquartered here in Amsterdam, as you just told me off the air. So that's really interesting. I guess a few years ago, you wouldn't imagine, you know, doing banking applications entirely in the cloud. And then, you know, nowadays you've got Monzo, a few other companies doing something similar. And I can imagine guys have a lot of interesting challenges from the infrastructure point of view, and have a full, you know, real estate of different cloud services, including containers and serverless. So I've got a lot of questions to ask you about how your system works. Before we get into that, though, do you want to take a moment and tell us about yourself and Open.com?
Yeah, sure. So about myself, Edward is my name. I've been working mainly all my life with .NET technologies as a backend cloud developer. And I started at Open 3-4 years ago. And at that point, Open is a fintech company, you can call that. We provide financial services to banks across Europe. And also in UK, now that Brexit is in place, I also need to say in UK. We provide financial services in the main domains. We provide savings, investments, mortgages and loans, and many are quite big range of products. So we are AWS focused. We were the first company to provide core banking engines in the cloud 10 years ago. So I remember Open starting, that was explained to me. Open sit in a room with AWS and they say, hey guys, we are gonna build a banking engine in AWS, so let's see how to do it. And that was 10 years ago. Also, 4 years ago when I started, Open was deciding to actually go full serverless. You can imagine 10 years ago, the API Gateway didn't exist. I think API Gateway was released on 2015. So you can imagine our stack at that point is quite classic. So load balancer, EC2 instances, RDS clusters, and many VPCs. So a quite classic stack. And 4 years ago, we went to serverless, and we decided to build a RESTful API for savings investment in based 100% on serverless, and that's what we did. And at that point, I started as a backend developer and transitioned later on the platform services team where I'm currently working at. And I moved from backend DevOps developer to currently a principal engineer, where I oversee the full platform that Open is providing to our customers.
That's really amazing. I didn't realize that you guys started out 10 years ago. So that's been a long time coming. And also, I didn't realize that you guys have decided to go fully serverless quite a few number of years ago, I guess 4 years ago, which is quite early for a banking application, which has some really, strict requirements, which 4 years ago, maybe Lambda, there's a lot of us edge cases, which wasn't quite as well covered as it is today. Let's start by looking at some high level picture in terms of how your system works. I imagine there's a lot of APIs. You mentioned API Gateway there. So I imagine you're using heavy use of API Gateway and the Lambda. What about, from a banking application point of view, there's going to be a lot of event-driven side of things as well. Are you also using something like EventBridge quite heavily in terms of, okay, great. So maybe tell us a bit about some example projects that you have and what it looks like from the architectural point of view.
Yeah, so our main products essentially at Open are APIs. So we build APIs that our customers consume. And also, a typical stack involves API gateway, load balancers, and APIs that are either hosted in EC2 instances, containers using ECS or Lambdas in the more modern setup. Indeed, most of our big databases are running in RDS, so those are hosted in several VPCs, and well, which is the classic approach. And either containers, EC2s, and Lambdas contact it via HTTP. In terms of how we moved to serverless, that was 3 years ago. At that point, you can imagine we had this classic stack, so mainly a lot of batch processing happening in RDS, also in EC2 instances. We had what's called the SOAP APIs exposed from those instances, and we had to go to RESTful approach. So what we did is slowly transition to Lambdas what was possible. And also transition to Fargate in ECS, the batch processing that were the easiest ones. And I would say we were quite successful. So we managed to completely move in RESTful APIs all the hundreds of endpoints that provided the platform for savings and investments. So you can think about operations like saving accounts, closing accounts, rebalance, all those financial things that your bank provide to you. And well, at that point, it was I'm gonna say a challenging process, and we succeeded for our new clients. And we are onboarding to RESTful the clients that have been with us for 10 years. I'm saying challenging because I did learn a lot. We did, and things to do, things to not to do. Things like, for example, when we started moving to Lambda, there was this approach. I think it's called shift and lift. It's something AWS promotes a lot for for migrating fast to Lambda, and it's something I valued at that point. But now that I have more experience and we are more experienced on Lambda, I don't think it was the best approach. So essentially, this approach embeds a whole web API within a Lambda and makes it run as a single function, and that's something that helped us a lot. But then we realize, oh, but the best practices in AWS say you should have a function for a single thing. And we are embedding an API with 50 endpoints inside. Also, the cold starts were quite complex to manage. The configuration of such Lambda, you can imagine at that point, web APIs, we designed them to spin up one time and have a long lifespan, and either in containers or in EC2 instances. So for us, it wasn't a problem that it took, I don't know, let's say 30 seconds to spin up and configure itself properly. But when we went to Lambda, we say, oh, wait, this is not gonna work. And we had to twist it, we had to split those APIs. So one thing I learned is that monolithic Lambdas, it's something painful. And in fact, we managed to actually have a pragmatic approach where we share certain big APIs running in Fargate, together with more single-purpose functions in Lambda, all of them connected via RDS proxy to our RDS databases. And that worked wonders for us. We also have batch processing managed in Fargate. And also, we started 2 years ago moving to more an event-driven approach, where we have most of our business logic is held in Lambdas and Fargates that are pulling events from SQS and even Bridge, and those then are doing all the asynchronous jobs that were done before inside the RDS cluster. Like I'm talking about the stored procedures that were locking certain tables, so things that didn't allow us to scale properly. Now we manage. Well, 2 years ago, we managed to move them to batches in the cloud, or simply event-driven architectures that really helped us a lot.
Okay, thanks for that. There's quite a few different points I'd like to sort of unpack and drill into it a bit more. You started off by saying that you were a .NET developer, and one of the things with Lambda is that cold start. You mentioned that as well. That .NET doesn't have the best cold starts. Nowadays, there's some tooling around .NET Native, which can bring really good cold start performance to .NET, I think 6 or 7 applications by compiling them to native first. You've got some API assets in Lambda. Are you still using .NET for those functions, or have you decided to move to something like a TypeScript where you have much better cold start performance with Lambda for those APIs which are presumably user facing?
We did, so I didn't mention it, but at Open, we are currently working with 5 languages. So we have a big part of the company mainly working in Java, and the other almost half of it works in .NET. And we also have Python and JavaScript around for mostly our serverless stack. About .NET and the cold start, indeed, .NET together with Java, I think, are the less fast programming languages in terms of cold start. But when we were building them in .NET, the cold start per se wasn't the big issue. So usually, the Lambdas, when they were starting, most of the time was spent on indeed the cold start, which is 3 4 seconds, and also a bunch of other 5 seconds on the configuration side of such Lambda. Things like when the startup class starts, Lambda was pulling SSM parameters, was also pulling secrets or other configurations from either Dynamo or credentials to access such configurations in SSM. And that is where we spend the most of our refactor and reconfiguration. So that's one thing. We had to change that. And the other thing, in terms of cold start, at that point we were building APIs that they work in what we call machine-to-machine process. So essentially, our customers' banks, they have their own systems, automated backend systems that are doing all the rebalances and all the calls to our APIs. And those are simply background processes. So although we did have some cold starts of 3 4 seconds, we weren't punished by it at that point. It's true that recently, 2 years ago, we started building our own front ends for our customers. At that point, we were only API only company, so we only exposed APIs to our customers. But some of them started asking, "Hey, could you also build a front end specific to our needs?" And we did it, of course. And that is where we experiencing a much more high demand in terms of performance and user facing APIs. Those APIs are also built fully in serverless. They are the last ones, so usually use the most modern setup. And there we leverage, instead of .NET and Java, we leverage Python and JavaScript. Usually our front end guys, we like them to be full stack, so we encourage them also to build their own backend for front end and even backends using Dynamo as the main source of database. And they use JavaScript, and they do not use TypeScript, so only JavaScript and Python.
Okay, got it. That makes a lot more sense. I guess when you're talking about, I guess, a bank-to-bank API calls, there's no real user waiting for a response, so you don't have to worry about that latency, the occasional or cold starts happening. So that's great. You talk about earlier that you migrated from having EC2 and containers to now using Fargate and Lambda for most of your things. How do you nowadays decide whether a workload should run inside Fargate or run inside Lambda? Since you've done that whole migration earlier, which I'd like to touch on a little bit more, how do you decide nowadays if someone was to say there's a new project we need to build? Help me decide if I should do that with Fargate or with Lambda.
Yeah, good question. And we had this question for long ourselves. So essentially, our approach at Open is we give complete freedom to teams to decide what they use. And essentially, serverless always makes its way to the designs. It's not something that we push for. So we don't say you must use Lambda, you must use Fargate, you must use Dynamo. We just say use all the tools you have available and make it scalable, resilient, and fast. And essentially, most of teams end up using Lambdas and Fargates. And the distinction between those two, what we do and what I promote personally as a principal engineer, is go Lambda first and then assess the limitations that Lambda has in terms of your workloads. So, for example, for APIs, for REST APIs, usually having one Lambda per operation makes a lot of sense, and this is what we promote. But for certain types of processes that take longer than 15 minutes or take longer to process than 30 seconds, that is what API Gateway usually limits you as a hard limit, then we say, well, maybe indeed you need to have an asynchronous process. Just say, have a for example, a Fargate container that API Gateway triggers, and then it responds with an accepted, and then it processes the request asynchronously without make the user waiting. Or if the request is it's a synchronous process that you cannot actually do that, and it takes longer than 15 minutes, then obviously Fargate is the way to go because Lambda it will time out. And so yeah, that was a long sentence, but essentially I'm saying as much as you can go asynchronous so you don't make the user wait. And then you have all the time in inside our system to process the event and the request. And if such process takes more than 15 minutes, then Fargate is the way to go. If it's less, then Lambda, of course.
Okay, so in this case, I guess API calls that takes more than 30 seconds, is that more for the sort of bank-to-bank API calls that are doing more complex transactions versus actual from coming from a UI?
Yeah, so we did have some operations that took indeed more than 30 seconds, and those were not let's say not following the best RESTful practices. So it was a request that was doing a bunch of operations in one after the other, yeah, and was also orchestrating the well. I need to call several subsystems inside my service, and I need to close the account. I need to check the rebalance in another microserver service. So what we end up doing in this case is essentially transform this process as asynchronous, either splitting it using step functions was one of the most successful ways. And then simply getting the request from the client via Lambda, responding with accepted, and then triggering the step function that was actually doing all the orchestration and calling all the microservices inside with all the time in the world.
Oh, thanks for that. Yeah, so that's a quite a well-known pattern from, I guess, service-oriented architectures days called decoupled invocation. I actually blog about that back in the 2017. So it's really interesting that you
Yes.
guys are also doing something very similar there to address a very similar issue. And I guess in that case, I was also going to just mention the step functions because when you talk about orchestration, you've got multiple API calls. I was going to say, I think, oh yeah, have you looked at the step functions? Because that's kind of sounds like something that step function could be really good there. And
Yes, indeed.
the step functions can also, if you use the express workflows, you can also be triggered asynchronously, or sorry, synchronously in terms of from API Gateway as well, which I've seen a few
Yes.
clients do that. So maybe going back to earlier, what you talked about earlier in terms of you having done that migration from EC2 and containers to now a combination of Fargate and the Lambda, you did some, I guess, re-architecture and rewrite of the application so that you're following best practices when it comes to working with Lambda, and you talk about what to do and what not to do. Can I just get the, you know, the details on what you decided are things that you should be doing and that you shouldn't do? One of them you mentioned already in terms of don't have monolithic Lambda functions where you just take the whole, .NET application and lift and shift it into a Lambda function. Are there any other things that you would say, you know, if for someone coming from someone doing something similar, doing that migration, what other things that would you recommend them do? Other things that you shouldn't recommend, that you recommend they don't do?
Yes, a lot of them. So when we started going serverless, we had, I think internally we had this small hiccup where we had a lot of hype. Like, whoa, serverless indeed is very useful, is the future. Let's do as much as possible. And I don't think companies and anybody should push or force to go serverless. I think as a developers, we had this problem where we were trying to use Lambda for everything all at once without really questioning it. And that's something I don't think you need to do. You need to let the expertise, the experience, and the know-how get across the organization before actually pushing for it. Because not all our workloads were ready to go Lambda, let's say. And that's something we had to discover as we went. So one of the errors that we did is indeed try to embed web APIs inside Lambdas that proved before production to not work. So we, at that point, we realized, hey, there are a bunch of other things we are not yet fully ready. So instead of pushing for Lambda, what we're gonna do is let's build what we call an IDP, an internal developer platform. Let's build a system. Let's have the freedom for developers so they can experiment and try things and fail as early as possible. And they will tell us what they want to use. And most of us end up using Lambdas and Fargate. But it wasn't something that we did from top to bottom. Although at the beginning we tried to do that, it's something that each one of us, we are a medium-sized company, like 300 people. So each one of us got the ownership and the know-how of using serverless containers and EC2s. And we decided together one by one to use Lambdas or Fargates. And then this decision scaled up to the top positions. And that's where I am, together with CTO and other individual contributors within Open. We built based on the feedback and the experiences that developers were having. And also, another thing that we learned is that so when we were building our applications, we had this I think now this debate is coming back, the cloud agnostic debate, and we were trying to build our functions and our applications like we should be able to run it in Azure, in Google Cloud, in Alibaba, everywhere. And at that point, we were sold by this mindset, like, oh yeah, we this vendor lock-in, this stuff. And I realized we were spending a lot of time and effort and money on something that we are not going to see anytime soon. So it's true that as a financial company, we are highly regulated and we are forced to have a plan in case we want to move through a different cloud provider. But it's just a plan. It has to work. We do some testing and indeed works. But I think the best vendor lock-in potion is having code and delivering code fast. So your code should be able to change fast. Fast means so you should be able to actually write a new line of code and ship it to production within the same day. And that will give you all the vendor lock-in remedies that you need.
That's a great one-liner that I can use as a quote for this podcast because people often talk about this whole vendor lock-in thing and they often talk about in sort of the banking regulated sectors. And I've spoken to quite a few different financial institutions. Like I said, turns out it's, you know, it's just that they want you to have a plan and that the regulators just, you know, cares about that as an industry, they are diverse. So within Netherlands, for instance, that not all the banks are running on AWS. Some will be running on Azure, some will be running on the Google Cloud. So on, there's some diversity in the industry as opposed to individual banks. No, they are happy and that the individual banks are responsible for having a plan in case they need to do something, you know, to move from AWS to something else because of some regulatory reasons. But it's not that they don't require you to have implementation so that you can actually move. And anyone who's ever done those kind of upfront planning, you know, knows that a lot of the time that stuff just doesn't work. When it's time to actually doing a move, I remember same arguments were being thrown around for ORMs in .NET, 15, 20 years ago. Everyone was talking about, oh yeah, you don't want to be locked into your database, so use ORMs. At one time, you need to do a migration from one database to another. It's a lot of work. You got to deal with the differences in the database, as well as the problems that the ORM layer has introduced in terms of, you not being able to see exactly what has been done under the hood and loads of other things. Those are the kind of problems that you think your solution is perfect up front, but when you actually need to do that migration, it's no easier. In fact, it takes longer and harder.
Yeah, completely agree. So one thing I every day promote within Open is what we call the legacy lock-in. So we don't want to be locked by our own potential legacy code. So things like what you mentioned, packages that gives you a mapping between the RDS or the SQL entities to your C# code, that's something that shouldn't work like that. And what we do is always try to have zero legacy, because this is the thing that will make it goes fast and be able to change cloud in case in the future we need to do so. And another thing you mentioned that remind me of conversations we have within Open is there is this mentality of cloud agnostic. Usually, or all the cases I've seen across many companies make people use the cloud in a non-efficient way. So you could always have a Docker image that you run in EC2, and you run in AWS, which works perfectly, and then say, well, now I can easily go to Azure because I can do the same virtual machine and embed all my containers. Yes, that indeed works, and you are sort of cloud agnostic, but you are also not using all the amazing features that AWS brings, and I'm sure Azure has its own and Google the same. So I think it's good that you can have this way of thinking, like, let's protect ourselves in case AWS goes down, which is something I hear often, and I'm always like, well, if AWS goes down, 90% of the internet will go down with it, so we'll see. But it's good to have this mentality, but it's also good to be efficient and you really use the full potential of your cloud provider, because then you will get much less costs and your application and time to market will be much less.
Yeah, totally agree. And also, you know, people talk about AWS going down. It was never go down as a whole. Individual data centers or availability zones or regions can go down or have problems. But you know, it's such a vast infrastructure spanning across countries and continents that there are different architectural patterns that protects you against different levels of failures, and they provide redundancies through multi-AZ, which you get out of the box with serverless, and then you got multi-region as well, which is a well-known pattern for guarding against the region-wide outages, which they are difficult, more complex, and they're more expensive to build and maintain, but the patterns are there. We're not inventing anything new here. And I love your quote there.
Of course.
the legacy lock-in. Someone should print that on a shirt, because that's
amazing. Maybe I will. yeah, indeed, because I mean, legacy is what is holding back many companies. I mean, it's not the cloud providers locking you in and trying to squeeze you money. It's usually most of your developers spend time on legacy code, maintaining it, trying to understand it. So yeah, legacy out always.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks for that. Let's see. I had some other notes there earlier. Okay, so those are the some to do and don't to do. What about in terms of actual migration patterns? Like really common one people talk about would be the strangler pattern, which I imagine this is probably something that you guys were using in terms of taking your legacy system and then breaking it apart and then moving it piece by piece. Are there any other sort of patterns that you have used? I guess you also talked about the pattern where you turn synchronous API calls that are slow and long running into asynchronous processes. Anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, so we've used the strangle pattern a lot. So you can imagine 5-10 years ago how our databases looked like. So we had one big monolith application accessing the same RDS with, now I'm eyeballing it because we reduced it quite a lot, but I think we were managing 1200 tables in a single database in an SQL cluster. So a big one indeed. So this pattern become very useful and very challenging. Because you can imagine we had both in the monolithic application, like 50 solutions in C#, all of them accessing at the same time the same tables. So that proved to be, so it wasn't obvious, oh, okay, this application is using these 10 tables, so let's put it in a microservice. So this wasn't possible in most cases. So what we end up doing is, I'm not sure the name of such pattern, so I'm just gonna try to explain it. So essentially what we did is an event-driven approach where microservices applications were receiving updates from each other, essentially using event bridge and queues to actually throttle or manage properly high loads. And the such microservices were using the same tables, but in different clusters or in different DynamoDBs if they were able to do so. So you can imagine, let's say we have 100 tables, so and two microservices. One microservices was using 50 tables and the other one was using 60. So there were overlapping between microservices. But each one of them was doing it on its own and was being updated via events. And that really speed us a lot. So we were able to independently deploy each one of those 50 microservices. We were then able on its own to refactor them properly and at the database level also and at the C# level. So that's another pattern. So I think it should be called asynchronous event-driven pattern, if I'm not mistaken. That was one of them. Also, asynchronous process with step functions proved to be the right solution for really legacy systems that we weren't able to, I mean, we weren't able to change it cost-effectively. So let's say changing a system that might take a month. Okay, let's abstract it behind a process via step functions and keep using it. So was another pattern. And yeah, many others I'm not remembering now.
Yeah, that's great. Especially the process of turning dependencies on a shared database into a shared event contract instead, and then building your system on top of those events and moving away from this shared database and start to populate your own data store for your microservice. That's a really good pattern. That's what I use for one of my previous jobs as well, when we went from a monolithic Node.js Express app to move away into smaller APIs, and then API Gateway and Lambda. We use that exact method, which really helps you identify the specific data points that you need for this service, and then you can start to migrate away from a shared database and start to populate your own data. One of the things that we did also there was we just moved the API first, so that all the requests, instead of going to the database directly, we changed the callers to go to the new API, and the new API would use the same database. And then we do that step by step to transition to then use the events, so that we depend on events from other systems, instead of using the their tables. And one of the things that I guess people often ask about is, what's wrong with sharing databases across multiple services? That's kind of the cardinal sin of doing microservices when you have a distributed monolith where everything is different APIs, but talking to the same database. I actually had a really good story from one of the companies I used to work for that had this. They did the migration to microservices, but it was never finished. So they had lots of APIs, but they're all talking to the same massive RDS instance with, I think, the maxed out EBS volumes, and they were paying huge amounts of money on the fastest, the maximum IOPS EBS volumes you can find on the biggest EC2 instances you can get your hands on as well. And then one day, one weekend, the whole system went down because someone was running a really complex query in a custom support tool, which of course they don't realize. So they ran a query, was so taxing on the database that it took it down. And because everything was sharing the same database, you had a single point of failure that took down the entire system over the weekend. So that was a food delivery service. And what was so funny was that as they went down over, it was like a dinner time on a Friday, so peak traffic time, which should have been devastating business-wise, especially when you got other similar competitors in the market. But what's funny was that everybody went to the competitor and took their system down as well. So I think there's a lot of badly engineered systems in the market. We just we just don't see them until they get stress tested by something like this.
You remind me of something. So when we are doing all this migration, personally, I did have this imposter syndrome. Because many, many times we had to be, I'm going to say, pragmatic. Okay, this is not the best approach, but it's going to work in the long term and it's going to enable us to refactor it properly. And we all were thinking, are we doing it right? It sounds like we are not doing what the industry is telling us. And this imposter syndrome was quite omnipotent across myself and the teammates. But then you start having conversation with other principal engineers across many other companies, and you realize that this pragmatism is everywhere. We are all facing the same issues, and we shouldn't be ashamed about, And you also mentioned something about your RDS the microservice sharing databases. And yes, that indeed is a sin that put us in a lot of stress. So we had a similar issue where indeed our support engineers were actually querying a lot our cluster, and our, let's say, write actions were being bothered by the read actions. And there, what we decided is to have a read replica for support. So essentially, RDS forwards the logs and events to the read replica, and those can be queried without bothering it. And also, then each microservices that we were able to migrate to use Dynamo or any other thing, we plugged in the same event approach. So essentially, Dynamo VS Streams was forwarding event change in Event Bridge, and those were reflected by the platform to the same RDS replica that the support engineers were still using. And for them, it became abstract. So essentially, they kept querying the same RDS, but the updates were coming from SQL databases, from NoSQL databases. And this proved to be something challenging because I'm just saying in a single sentence what took us months. But I think we did the right thing. And it wasn't the most shiny one, you know, having a replica for reading because our RDS cluster is getting overwhelmed doesn't sound very serverless, but it worked and we are very proud of.
Yeah, when it comes to migration, you want to do step by step, but you want to do safely and slowly rather than try to do a big bang and get to your sort of ideal end state in one go. And I think I'm more for pragmatism. It's better to deliver value quicker, but making the architectural changes and technical changes are slower than the other way around, where you try to be moving too fast on the technical side of things and then end up breaking a system in ways that you couldn't predict earlier. And I guess on the Event Bridge, I do have a question as well. I imagine you have different accounts for different teams and different environments. And the one common question that comes up a lot when you've got this, I guess, more sort of diversified AWS accounts environment is what do you do with Event Bridge? What topology or pattern do you use? In your case, do you have like a central account running your central event bus, and then everybody would publish to say a local Event Bridge bus, and then forward it to the central one, and then everyone would subscribe from the central one through the resource policies stuff that they support now, or do you have a different pattern for sharing events through Event Bridge?
Great question, and one that gave us a lot of headaches. So essentially, let me briefly explain what our AWS setup is because it's quite complex. So we have, as I mentioned before, our internal developer platform that I'm not going to go into details, but essentially allows each one of us via pull request to create and configure accounts. AWS accounts based on our baselines, and baselines are potential configuration setups. So there's one baseline for load balancers, one baseline for ECS cluster, one baseline for APIs and how to be exposed to clients, and many other dozens. So what we have now is currently in this system around 200 AWS accounts, and what we do is for each one of our clients, we define a set of independent accounts. So you can imagine, for example, one of our most known clients is National Netherlands, NN. And you can imagine for NN, we have the production environment, the stage environment, the development environment, so they can also connect with us. So 3, 4, 5 accounts per customer. We have, and customers also mean teams and everybody that wants an AWS account. So for most clients, we follow a pattern where we have a central Event Bridge, usually isolated in a single account. So you can imagine let's say a client is using our mortgages and savings proposition. So each one of those proposition and set of microservices, they are running in what we call workload accounts. So they are accounts dedicated per client, environment, and service. So all the savings APIs run in a single AWS account for a specific client in production, and they are isolated from the APIs or any process that is running for the mortgages services. And each one of those accounts, they forward events to our central Event Bridge, which is in a third account. And there we what we have is the setup. We use EvenBridge. I think it's called Schema Discovery, which essentially it's our way of discovering all the events and that the application between different domains need to forward to each other. One thing that we struggled a lot is the contract check. Contract check, I mean, usually when there's a, let's say there's an application in mortgages sending the event of a new mortgage request created, that goes to EvenBridge and it should have a specific contract, a specific who is requesting it and some metadata. And at that point, as far as I know, EvenBridge still doesn't support this this contract check when somebody's publishing it. So what we end up doing is something that I think, I'm not sure if anybody is doing, but essentially what we put in our internal developer platform, that's something developers get out of the box. We put API Gateway in front of our EvenBridge, and we use API Gateway models to actually check the events that developers are publishing. So you can imagine, instead of going directly to our central EvenBridge per environment, they do an HTTPS request to our API Gateway, where the body is the event that they want to publish. And there in API Gateway, we can have as many models as event contracts we are defining. And that gave us extremely a lot of agility and speed, because now developers had a way of actually checking that they were doing something wrong without actually publishing it. So when a developer was sending an event with a wrong contract, the API Gateway was able to tell it, hey, that's a 400, that's a bad request, and you should follow this contract. And we were able to do that. And now when teams are developing, they move more confidently to acceptance and production-like environments, because we have this system that is actually synchronously telling us if we are doing it right or wrong. And that was very nice.
That's great. I didn't realize that NN is your client. I actually had Vijay from NN on my podcast a couple episodes back. They're also going fully serverless. So anyone who's interested about NN and how they are doing serverless, check out the episode. I've included the link in the show notes. And what you talk about just now, the approach for validating the event contracts when you publish your events, is very similar to what PostNL does. I actually also had Luke Van Donkersgood from PostNL on my podcast recently as well. I also include a link to that episode where they talk about a very similar thing where they have internally an event broker partially to facilitate the targets that are not supported by SNS and EventBridge and other AWS services, and also to then be able to capture the contracts so that when you try to publish your contract for a new version of your event, you can do some validation to make sure that you are backward compatible. So similar to, if you think about it, similar to what you do with consumer-driven contracts, except a process that's, better defined. I've been spending a lot of time for my testing serverless architectures course on researching consumer-driven contracts. It's the last lesson that I haven't published yet, because I've been researching it for event-driven architectures, and I'm really surprised by how little I see. And I thought it would be a really well-suited pattern, but nobody's doing it as far as I can tell. And the support from Pact is also seems quite flimsy, and is barely anything there. And the example they have there also it's just really, really basic. So
true.
So I think people are building their own solutions at the moment to solve this problem in terms of contract validation, because EventBridge doesn't support it. There's no support for sort of checking backward compatibility, and also at runtime when you try to publish those events, there's no validation that you're not breaking the contract that you have with your consumers. So those are things that I hope they will fix soon. But right now, it sounds like you and the PostNL are doing something very similar. So,
yes.
Go on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So PostNL, we don't have a contract with them. We do not collaborate together, but I follow its principal engineer, which name now I don't remember. I'm sorry. But he's very active on the community, and he posts a lot about how they are doing things in meetups and in blogs. And I follow him, and I realize many patterns we are also using. And I was also getting inspired by him in some ways of working. There's one thing you mentioned that remind me of one other challenge we faced with EvenBridge. EvenBridge is amazing. Let's have this out of the box. It just has some things that are so convenient that you are always expecting to be there also. Things like, you know, contract event check-in. And also the other thing we struggled a lot was with having FIFO patterns. So we wanted at some point to use EvenBridge, but still have the proper order of events to our application consumer, and EvenBridge, it's not meant for that. So what we end up doing is, thanks to this abstraction layer that we put around EvenBridge, which is API gateway. So essentially developers and our clients, they see a REST endpoint to send events to. That way, our platform was able to build inside our event broker several patterns, and one pattern to support FIFO was essentially connecting API gateway with SQS, with many SQS queues, and connecting then the consumers of specific event topics to the queue in question. That allow us to have inside this abstraction layer a FIFO pattern. So essentially, you as a developer within Open, you say, hey, I have this application, I want to react to those events, and I want to react them in a FIFO pattern because I need to get them in a certain order. The IDP does it for you. So you receive an endpoint and you say, here you will you can publish events, and you can also pull them from this queue. And out of the box, without any implementation detail, they can pull them in the proper order. And the same happens for the clients. And that's something we had to come up by ourselves. And I hope EvenBridge also supports at some point FIFO. But it was super interesting to come up with it by ourselves.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about Luke, who I interviewed for the podcast with PostNL. So I've also included Luke's social media links as well, so that anyone who wants to learn about event-driven architectures and you know, some of the patterns that he's been publishing, you can find him in the links below. Yeah, so thanks for that. I think Luke may have also mentioned something around this, doing something similar in their event broker as well. I can't remember. I need to go back and listen to the episode again myself. But that's a really nice pattern. I like that being able to kind of abstract away EventBridge so that the subscribers are not necessarily aware of where the events are coming from. So you could come from SQS FIFO through, I guess, SNS FIFO and fanout and get FIFO messages instead of coming directly from EventBridge and losing their order. That's a really nice pattern. So talking about things that the AWS is not doing, well, I know we're still some way away from reInvent, but I'd like to get maybe some items from you in terms of your AWS wishlist item, things that you wish they would implement or fix in the coming months or years.
So yeah, I've been thinking about that. So I think we mentioned a couple of them. So I liked EvenBridge to do contract checking, and also FIFO out of the box. And I know it's not easy, so I'm hoping they will fix it eventually. Well, it's not a fix. It's more of a nice to have that I'm looking forward to it. There are other things around how we build APIs. So we use Cognito for authentication and authorization, and the no, I think we are good to cover. I was thinking in something that Cognito is also supporting, so no request there. Yeah, I think those two will be fine. EventBridge mainly.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, EventBridge is contract tracking in the EventBridge layer as well as FIFO. Those are really popular requests. I've wanted that. Well, I've wanted them for myself as well. So hopefully we see them sometime soon.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, one thing I learned from, well, I learned, I was already suspicious about and last reInvent, the AWS CTO said, right? The success in cloud, I think, comes from the right abstractions. And this is what we are doing well, I think, at Open. We are building the right abstractions for our consumers, either being clients or other teams. That this give us the agility and this small hiccups of, oh, EventBridge is not doing FIFO. Once you have the knowledge and experience, you can easily build your own solution in serverless, which is, I think it has a real beauty and I like doing, of course.
Yeah. That's I totally agree there as well. So yeah, I think we are out of time now, and thanks so much, Eduard, for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been great. There's so many small nuggets of things that
yes, indeed. Thanks.
Yeah, things like legacy locking.
yes. I think this is the sentence for this podcast: legacy locking out. Yeah, thanks, Ayan, for having me. I've been following you a lot and doing all your courses, and I'm looking forward to this last class in testing serverless architectures, because I know you are working on it. So thanks. And yeah, thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, I hope to wrap up that last lesson. Probably not with the initial recommendation that I had in mind based on my research. So maybe just not quite mature enough for me to recommend people to start doing consumer-driven contract testing with event-driven architectures, not without writing a whole bunch of custom tooling yourself, at least for the time being. I'll wrap it up once I have more, solidify my thinking a bit more. And yeah, thank you so much again for your time today. And I wish you all the best. And
thanks.
If you're ever in the Netherlands area, let's maybe meet up again next time.
Sure, let's do it. Cool. Thanks, Jan.
Take it easy, man.
Have a good day.
So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.